This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moscowain. The New York Times' Michiko Kakutani recently reviewed How to Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia and wrote that the author, Mohsin Hamid, who had written two previous novels, had, quote, reaffirmed his place as one of his generation's most inventive and gifted writers. Told in the second person, this novel tells the story of a poor boy who does make it rich in the big city in the bottled water business. It's written in the form of one of those popular self-help books with chapter titles like Get an Education, Don't Fall in Love, Work for Yourself, Befriend a Bureaucrat, Have an Exit Strategy, and one that's new to me, Be Prepared to Use Violence. Mohsin Hamid is the author of Moth Smoke, which was a finalist for the Penn Hemingway Foundation Award, and The Reluctant Fundamentalist, which was shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize. And he joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. Congratulations on your book, and nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
I'd love to have you begin with the very beginning of your novel.
Look, unless you're writing one, a self-help book is an oxymoron. You read a self-help book so someone who isn't yourself can help you, that someone being the author. This is true of the whole self-help genre. It's true of how-to books, for example, and it's true of personal improvement books, too. Some might even say it's true of religion books, but some others might say that those who say that should be pinned to the ground and bled dry with the slow slice of a blade across their throats. So it's wisest simply to note a divergence of views on that subcategory and move swiftly on. None of the foregoing means self-help books are useless. On the contrary, they can be useful indeed. But it does mean that the idea of self in the land of self-help is a slippery one. And slippery can be good. Slippery can be pleasurable. Slippery can provide access to what would chafe if entered dry. This book is a self-help book. Its objective, as it says on the cover, is to show you how to get filthy rich in rising Asia. And to do that, it has to find you, huddled, shivering, on the packed earth under your mother's cot one cold, dewy morning. Your anguish is the anguish of a boy whose chocolate has been thrown away, whose remote controls are out of batteries, whose scooter is busted, whose new sneakers have been stolen. This is all the more remarkable since you've never in your life seen any of these things.
And that's Mohsin Hamid reading from the very beginning of his new novel called How to Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia. And the notion of writing a novel as a self-help book is so intriguing. I've always thought self-help books are ridiculous in that no one actually ever takes advice, if you know what I mean.
I think that's true. I mean, there is something slightly ridiculous about the self-help book. But we're getting self-help all the time in magazines and newspapers. So much of what we read is self-help. And I think in a weird way, even novels are self-help, because writing a novel for a novelist is an attempt to help yourself. And even reading novels can be that.
And the idea, I even think of memoirs. I mean, that you're looking for yourself in someone else's writing.
Absolutely. I think, when we think of what we are as selves, we're basically stories that we tell ourselves. And when we hear someone else telling a story, it reflects back at the story we tell ourselves about ourselves.
So where did this idea of writing a novel as a self-help book, where did that come from for you?
I was actually in New York City. I was visiting from Pakistan, where I live. I was there for a literary festival. And I bumped into a friend of mine who's an editor at a literary magazine. And he and I were joking. We were both jet-lagged. And he was saying how he was reading a novel that was very good, but was really hard going, and he was doing it because it was good for him. And I said, yeah, it feels sometimes like reading novels is an exercise we do in self-help. And we both laughed. And I said, well, my next novel is going to be a self-help book. And I thought it was a joke. But when I went back to Pakistan and I tried to forget it, the more I tried to get away from the idea, the more I thought, actually, that's maybe what I'm doing. And from that, it became not a joke, but the actual novel.
So did you read self-help books as part of your research for your novel?
No, I didn't read any self-help books. But I think, every day I come across so many articles that I read about, how to avoid getting cancer, how to be a good father, how to not put on weight. So I think we're bombarded by self-help.
There's something I scribbled as I was reading your book, a reference to textbooks as whores. So are textbooks not self-help books, but they are prostitutes or whores?
Well, if all books are self-help books,
yes,
and textbooks are so obviously trying to teach you something, they're not flirting with you at the self-help book party. They're really just propositioning you and say, pay me some money because I'm going to help you.
This book is written in the second person, and I have to say, as I began to read it yesterday, it was off-putting because you're using the word you, and I'm so used to, so which kind of puts the story back on me. Was that the idea?
Yeah, well, you know, it's an interesting thing because it's a big ask to tell the reader, look, there's going to be a you instead of a he or she as the main character. And for me, it was actually central and really important to the book, because the book is a story of a boy who grows up and moves to the city and falls in love. But it is also the story of a writer writing, who is me, and the story of a reader reading, who is you. And that story requires a kind of direct conversation between us, mm-hmm. and the you makes that possible.
Because the you, when you're writing this, were you thinking of me reading it?
Yeah, well, I was thinking not necessarily specifically of you, but I was thinking of a reader. And I think that has a lot to do with how I believe novels work. I think novels are so much created by readers that they become a kind of dance between reader and writer. It's not me on the stage by myself. It's me and a partner dancing. And the you reminds me of that, and it reminds me that I'm half of a book.
This boy that we meet in the very beginning of the book, he has no name through the book. But for you as a writer, did you name him? Does he have a name for you?
No. I mean, none of the characters have names, and the place has no name. And the city, there's no name of religion, etc. And I originally started doing that because I was looking at Pakistan. I was thinking, how am I going to write about this place where I don't absorb the stereotypes and news coverage I've read so much about my own homeland? And I thought, you know, if I don't use the word Pakistan, I don't use the word Islam, I don't use the word the words of names that are from that place, I can write a story that is particular to this place, but could equally well be in Sao Paulo or Caracas or Mexico City or, you know, Lagos. And it's a city novel, really. And so, not having the names, it wasn't that I had names and took them away.
Right.
It was, I think, not having names enabled me to look for something universal.
Did that free you up as a writer? I mean, to feel like, oh my goodness, now I have this, all these possibilities.
It really
did.
I'm
not nailed down to a particular character or place.
No, I'm glad you asked that because I really feel that that's what happened. Is that, you know, in a way, the novel is a realistic novel. It's realism, but sometimes as a writer, when you name things, you feel you have to be faithful. Am I really describing Lahore the way it is? Am I really describing this thing? Whereas when you don't have the names, you can use your imagination and just be free. It was really freeing.
In that reading, we meet this young boy. He's not feeling well. He's underneath his mother's cot. And his parents are trying to figure out how to get him better. And he's in the countryside. It's clearly in squalid conditions.
Yes. I mean, what's happening in the countryside is there's a number of different trends. So on the one hand, you have a huge expanding population, and the countryside just can't provide enough work for these people. And then on top of that, you have environmental degradation, and you have tyrannical landlords who abuse the people who work the fields. And so people are fleeing the countryside, and he is part of that mass exodus.
That great migration from the countryside to the city. And even as I was reading that, I was thinking here in this country when you know, African Americans moved from the South to the North to find a better life. Some found it, some didn't.
Exactly. I mean, I think 20th century American history and the movement from the countryside of people who felt either underutilized or oppressed there is a lot like 21st century Asian history.
You write that the supportive, stifling, stabilizing bonds of extended relationships weakening and giving way, leaving in their wake insecurity, anxiety, productivity, and potential. Obviously, the move from the country to the city comes with a great price. I mean, some positive and some negative.
Yeah, in a way, it's the you're on your own, even if you're just your small family now, but you've lost that clan. And And that move means you're free to sort of be yourself or who you want to be, maybe more than you were before. But you are also alone. And that creates all kinds of tensions mm-hmm. and fears.
He goes to a school and has a very, I would say, very brutal teacher. He's smart, but that he gets punished by the teacher quite brutally. Is that a common experience? Was that something you ever experienced?
Well, you know, I actually went to a school where teachers weren't allowed to hit you. But many of my cousins went to schools where, you know, canings and ruler smackings and all sorts of stuff was pretty frequent.
And the teacher, as he's described in this book, I mean, he hates teaching, but he's teaching. And I'm assuming, you know, who wants to be stuck in a room with kids if you don't actually want to be there?
I know. I can't imagine a job that would be worse than a teacher who doesn't like teaching.
Right. And you went to school in California in part?
For 6 years.
For 6 years. What grades?
From age 3 to age 9, so until 4th grade.
Right. And didn't have teachers that would beat you up?
No. I had very good teachers, actually.
This young man meets the pretty girl. Who's the pretty girl?
Well, he meets this young woman, a teenager, and she wants to get out of the slum that they both live in the city. And she is trying to find her way out. And so she is going to abandon sort of a lot of the values that they have in that part of the city. You know, sexual values and family loyalty values and a woman's place in society. She's going to challenge all that stuff mm-hmm. and run off and try to be a model and try to get on TV and do all these things. And she is pursuing a kind of Asian dream just as he is pursuing it. And that takes them both away from where they started.
And they have a shared love for movies. He's basically selling videotapes. And at some point he says, I know everything about movies. Does that reflect your passion and interest in movies?
You know, I'm actually a big movie buff. I love movies, and I watch a lot of movies. So, yes, and I think I've also had the experience now of seeing a movie made of one of my books, and I appreciate movies much more than I did before.
What do you love about movies, or are there some kinds of movies that you do love?
You know, I have to say I'm pretty omnivorous. So I'm from a nice, you know, subtitled art film to a full-blown, you know, galactic space battle. As long as it is successful on the terms in which it was created, I'm happy.
So the idea that a B film, don't aspire to be something that you're not?
Well, or I mean, not even don't aspire to be something that you're not, but be successfully what you are. And so it doesn't mean that it has to have some great moral relevance, but if it is, you know, if it is true to what it wants to be, it can really be exciting for me.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Mohsin Hamid is our guest today on Radio Times. His new novel is titled How to Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia. A great title, if I can say that. Much more after this very short break, including another reading from the book. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. Composed in 1822, it went unperformed for over 40 years, never finished, heard only in Schubert's imagination. Christoph von Dohnányi leads the Philadelphia Orchestra in Schubert's unfinished symphony and also leads Bruckner's fourth symphony, The Romantic. Tickets at 215-893-1999 or philorc.org. March 14th, 15th, and 16th at the Kimmel Center, Schubert's unfinished symphony with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
The budgetary discussions currently taking place in Washington present challenges for people in our community and for WHYY. Yet, at the same time, we have continued to expand our services. I'm Bill Morazzo. Your support to WHYY in the last 5 years has offset government losses, yet resulted in the growth of the services you rely on. A donation today will enable us to continue to fulfill our promise to you. Visit WHYY.org to make a donation.
This week in This American Life, Blake's friend Camille sent him an old photograph of herself. In it, she's a little kid on vacation with her family in Canada.
And then I glanced back at the picture, and I saw my grandma walking through behind her.
Blake and Camille grew up in different states. Camille didn't know him at that age or his grandma. Coincidences, do they mean anything this week?
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Mohsin Hamid about his new novel called How to Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia. I should add that his second novel, The Reluctant Fundamentalist, has been made into a movie, in fact, directed by Meera Nair. It opens sometime later this spring. I would love to have you read another section of your book. And again, to our listeners, this is a novel written in the form of a self-help book.
Many self-help books offer advice on how to fall in love, or, more to the point, how to make the object of your desire fall in love with you. This, to be absolutely clear, is not one of those self-help books. Because as far as getting rich is concerned, love can be an impediment. Yes, the pursuit of love and the pursuit of wealth have much in common. Both have the potential to inspire, motivate, uplift, and kill. But whereas achieving a massive bank balance demonstrably attracts fine physical specimens desperate to give their love in exchange, achieving love tends to the opposite. It dampens the fire in the steam furnace of ambition, robbing of essential propulsion an already fraught upriver journey to the heart of financial success.
And that's how the chapter Don't Fall in Love begins. I found that quite intriguing. And does it in any way reflect your thinking?
Well, no. I mean, I guess I never got filthy rich, so maybe and I'm
at least not yet.
Yeah,
right?
I'm married, I have two kids, so I've clearly not followed the advice. But I guess in the novel, I was setting up two things. There's one narrative in human life which is about growth, getting a bigger car, more money, more assets, etc., and that's the narrative that the market gives us. And then there's another narrative which is about loss. Getting older, getting frailer, losing the people we love. And the question is, how do we address that side of human existence? Mm-hmm. And, you know, in many traditions and throughout history, etc., you know, one of the central ways is to find things that make you less central in your life. And certainly love can be one of those things. So, in a sense, love, it counteracts some of the desperation that you might need for success.
But I think it should be fair to say that the now man in this story does fall in love. He's in love with a pretty girl.
He does. And fortunately for his financial prospects, it doesn't work out so cleanly. So he is in love with her his whole life. And she has a certain attachment to him. But theirs isn't really a possessive kind of a love. It's just an attachment that endures, you know, their whole existence.
Where did the title of this book come from? And I have to say, it's just fun to say it. How to Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia.
You know, it was sort of an over-the-top title. I thought, you know, if it were a self-help book, you know, what would I call it? And I thought, this is a very, you know, a really hit you in the face kind of a title. And because the novel is partly about this, but partly about something different, I like the sound of it. I like the implied humor of it.
Well, and the idea of filthy rich. I mean, I kept coming back to that, the idea of getting rich, but there's, you know, there's some dirt associated with
that. Yeah, it's true. And I think, you know, in so many languages, there is some term like that, you know, filthy rich. And it's like the you know, the Balzac quote that behind every great fortune is a great crime. Mm-hmm. That isn't necessarily true, but there is some idea that something untoward happens along the way to getting that much money.
Well, certainly in this country, we have this, you know, notion of the American dream, the kind of rags to riches story. I was also almost going to say Alger Hiss, but I know it's Horatio Alger,
yes,
being a good example of that. Do you think that's true in most countries? And is it true, do you think, in your country, Pakistan?
Well, there are people who make it. You know, there are people who move up. There's millions of people who become middle class, which is growing rapidly. And there's, you know, thousands, many thousands of people who become rich. Most, like everywhere, don't make it. But in Pakistan, I guess it's a little harder because there are fewer rules. So so you have to do more things to get there. And that means, you know, whether it's corruption or dealing with violence or whatever, it's a tougher journey.
I'm thinking, though, certainly in this country, there is this growing and great divide now between the very rich and the very poor. Is that getting closer to the way things are in Pakistan from your perspective?
You know, it's interesting because I do feel there's a kind of convergence between Asia and America. in the sense that much of Asia is now urbanizing, it's educating its people, it's building a middle class, it's allowing people to succeed and become wealthy, and it's learning from America, really. And at the same time, America is actually in the process of creating a larger poor class for itself. And there's a whole bunch of reasons why that's happening. But in doing so, it comes to resemble a bit more a country like Pakistan, obviously a much better off version, but a country like Pakistan than it did maybe 10 or 20 years ago.
And I got the impression from reading the book that there is as Pakistanis look at this country, both a sort of envy and a resentment. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, well, I think envy always comes with resentment. And the strongest resentments probably always come with a little bit of envy. So those two things are related. There's clearly America has been a very successful country, both for its citizens and as a nation state, and people want to emulate much of that. But on the other hand, there are many things that people resent, and there are many things that people feel are mm-hmm. unjust.
There's a housing development, I guess you could say, in this novel, almost a continent unto itself. Can you describe that?
Well, basically, they in Lahore, where I live, and throughout Asia, there are these housing colonies being built, and they're like walled-off little enclaves, which you now have in America, too, a gated community. But the difference is that in the housing development in this book, the gated community has its own electricity generator because there's not enough electricity. And it has its own clean water supply because otherwise tap water is filthy. And so it's like a little enclave that mimics America or Europe and doesn't let outsiders in. So it's almost as though the same way immigrants want to get into America, they want to get into one of these enclaves.
Sort of a country within a country, then.
Exactly.
That's Mohsen Hamid, our guest today on Radio Times, and we're talking about his new novel. It's called How to Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia, and he's the author of several other novels. One that is entitled, and I'm scrambling here, here we go, The Reluctant Fundamentalist, has been made into a movie directed by Mira Nair, and it was shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize. Hoping this doesn't give too much of your story away, but the hero, if I can say, or the man in the story does become a wealthy tycoon, and in part by getting into the bottled water business.
Well, one of the things just going on is all over the world, things that weren't necessarily part of the market are becoming part of the market. So it used to be that water was nearly free and, you know, you could just drink it. But now that's no longer the case. And so all over Asia and in much of the world, water is becoming increasingly in short supply. And so people are doing all kinds of things with it, selling bottled water, purifying it, cleaning it, and it's becoming expensive. And so our hero discovers two things. One, that there's this market for water, and he should get into it. And second, that if you really want to compete at it, why actually sell mineral water? Why not just take tap water, boil it a little bit, and pretend it's mineral water?
Well, and I've always thought that that's probably true for some of the some of the water that we spend all this money on.
Yeah.
That someone just boiled it somewhere and threw it in a bottle.
I think it's entirely possible. But the good thing is that, you know, in the States, most of the time when you drink the water out of your tap, it's just as healthy as mineral water. There's no real reason to have mineral water. But in Pakistan, that's not the case.
But here he is, and he becomes a, you know, quote-unquote tycoon because he figures out how to boil water, and he does boil it. It's not as if he doesn't do that, but puts it in these recycled bottles.
Well, he gets used water bottles, and gets a little machine that gets them sealed and puts a security tamper-resistant cap on them, right. And they look like originals. Right. And he sells those,
and becomes very rich doing that.
He becomes quite rich.
I'd love to have you read a third section from your book here, and I put post-its all in mine, and this is a chapter that's titled Be Prepared to Use Violence, part of this self-help narrative.
Distasteful though it may be, it was inevitable in a self-help book such as this that we would eventually find ourselves broaching the topic of violence. Becoming filthy rich requires a degree of unsqueamishness, whether in rising Asia or anywhere else. For wealth comes from capital, and capital comes from labor, and labor comes from equilibrium, from calories in chasing calories out, an inherent inbuilt leanness, the leanness of biological machines that must be bent to your will with some force if you are to loosen your own financial belt and, sighingly, expand.
Are you saying something about capitalism here? I mean, the sort of inherent violence of capitalism?
Well, I think, you know, that capitalism is the wild, in a way. You know, it's nature, which is a very violent thing. And it's nature with some rules, obviously, but it's a brutal mm-hmm. thing. Now, it's not clear if we have any better alternative to it, and there are certainly ways to make it more humane. So I'm not saying that we have to completely disregard capitalism, but I think unfettered capitalism, and that is something which exists in Pakistan because the state doesn't do much. It doesn't enforce the laws, doesn't collect many taxes, people have lots of guns. You have this whole environment of this unfettered capitalistic enterprise, and it is brutal for people.
Well, and our hero has to face some of that violence.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's scary being a tycoon.
Absolutely. It's scary being poor, and it's scary being rich in a country where people are poor.
Did you in any way draw on Bollywood for this novel?
No, I didn't. I think though that of course, you know, this rags to riches story is a Bollywood story, it's a Hollywood story, it's a fairy tale. And it's one of the classic stories that we human beings have. So it's nothing new in terms of a plot line. But as they say, there are only a few stories that exist and we just improvise mm-hmm. around them.
Was this a hard book to write?
Yes and no. It took 6 years, and my previous two took 7 each. So in that sense, I guess I'm maybe getting quicker. But I threw away the first 2 or 3 years' worth of work, and about three or four years in, I finally figured out how to do this thing. I spent a lot of time trying to make my novels work and just failing. And eventually, some form comes to me and a voice comes to me. And in this case, the voice you've heard in the form is a self-help book, and that unlocks the project.
I'm imagining spending several years working on a novel in this case and then tossing it. It didn't sound right to you? It didn't feel right to you?
Yeah.
It didn't look good on the page?
It used to hurt a lot earlier when I was a writer. My first novel, 7 years, the first draft I threw away, the second draft I threw away, the third draft I threw away, and eventually something came out of it. And then my second novel, I thought it was going to be different. And I wrote a draft. I was convinced it was good, and my agent told me it wasn't, and my editor said it wasn't, and I went back and did the redrafting. This time, I didn't bother showing it to anybody. I just kept working on it, and you know, my wife read it in the final draft stage. Mm. But for years, I wasn't sharing it with anyone because I knew I was going through this process of tossing it away. And what I realized was that I had been mistaking, you know, the cocoon for the butterfly. You know, these drafts are actually the thing inside which the novel comes alive. They're how I, you know, the first drafts are how I just tell the story, I get to know the characters, I figure out what I'm doing. And only when that's in place can I actually write a decent book.
Hmm. But the idea, I guess, of not possessing, I mean, those early words that you put on page, the idea of that that's just to help you unlock where the real story is.
Yeah, because I think really what it is it's a quest. You know, I don't know the answer. If I knew the answer, I would write the first draft and be done with it. But I'm actually figuring it out. And so being completely lost and writing words that won't last is part of figuring it out.
Do you have a tough little editor who sits on your shoulder and, you know, criticizes you as you write?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, unfortunately, I've got an agent and an editor who are both editors who are all, you know, wonderfully honest. And my wife is pretty honest. So I've internalized, I think, the mm-hmm. fact that I don't want to get into a fight with them when they tell me it's not good because I show the novel and they say it's not good and I say, well, I don't know.
So they're sitting on your shoulder.
Yeah, well, I'm like, you know, I'm not sure this relationship is very good and, you know, I'm not sure that we should be even discussing my books and I get over it quickly, but I have that initial petulant tantrum when somebody says it's not good and then I realize they're right.
Well, and honesty. I mean, you know, isn't that really what a writer of fiction is looking for?
Yeah, I mean, it's at the core of it all, is that, you know, we make stuff up, but what you're going for is honesty. And so you need it from readers, and you need to try to keep it for yourself.
And that's what takes all the sort of digging and editing and rewriting.
Yeah.
Is to get to what something that feels honest.
Absolutely. Because, you know, one thing which I do is I read my stuff aloud to myself over and over again, and I try to sift out the pebbles out of the sand of the sentences. And it, you know, only until it sounds right do I feel like it's okay. But yeah, I think that's what it is. Partly it's, you know, why does anybody write novels? You must have some degree of nuttiness about you and some issue that you're trying to deal with to spend years in a room by yourself. And I think, you know, part of that, of dealing with that craziness, whatever it is, unsettledness, is this thing of trying to create a work that honestly represents what you want it to represent.
I know that this phrase from Haruki Murakami has been inspirational to you. Writing a long novel is like survival training. Physical strength is as necessary as artistic sensitivity. Why is that so meaningful to you?
Well, you know, on the one hand, it's obviously not entirely true. You know, we have. I'm not sure the Brontes, you know, were that tough, and Virginia Woolf and Nabokov and many other
tough
people.
Meaning like jogging.
Yeah,
or
I don't know if they could do the ultra marathons and triathlons that Murakami pulls off. I certainly can't. But I did like something in that, which is it doesn't apply to all writers. But what he's, I think, really saying is that, you know, your physical self is the vessel inside which your creativity takes place. And I was really stuck on this book, and I was trying to find a way to get unstuck. So he runs for 5 or 10 miles a day. I thought, I'll walk. He writes long novels. I thought, you know, I write short novels. I don't have to match Murakami in his machismo. I'll just sort of, you know, amble along. And I started walking 1, 2, 3, eventually 5 miles a day every morning at 6 or 7 in the morning. And it really made an enormous difference. It made an enormous difference to me, I suppose, in a health sense, but it made a difference to my creativity because I had just these long periods of being alone with my thoughts. And when I sat down to write, I was completely revved up.
Were you conscious as you were walking that you were working on your novel, or did you kind of let your mind, imagination go?
Well, both. You know, sometimes I'd be walking and I would have this idea for an entire sentence or paragraph, and I would be texting it to myself on my cell phone as I walk. And other times I would just be watching, you know, the birds and the trees and just sort of drifting. But both of those things are important.
But the idea is that really helped you unlock this story?
It does, because it's you know, this, there's an imaginary world that you're creating as a novelist, and that imaginary world needs an environment in which it can exist. And, you know, I'm a full-time novelist, but I'm also, you know, at least a part-time dad. I have 2 small children, and I think, you know, finding the space for that creativity to occur is important, and a walk by yourself is one way to do it.
Let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation with Mohsen Hamid, and his book is called How to Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia. His a previous book, The Reluctant Fundamentalist, was shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize, and Moth Smoke was a finalist for the Pen Hemingway Foundation Award. We're going to talk more after this very short break. Also open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
The University of Pennsylvania supports WHYY. Do your drinking habits cause problems in your personal or professional life? Do you drink to cope with stress? These may be signs of alcohol dependence. UPenn is conducting a research study using naltrexone, an FDA-approved medication for use in treating alcoholism. If you are 18 or older, have an alcohol problem, and want to reduce your drinking, you may qualify for the study. Details at drinkinginphilly.com.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. This year marks her 20th anniversary on the court, and she turns 80. Our guest, Jeffrey Toobin, profiles her in The New Yorker. He says she may look frail and ready to retire,
but she is tough as nails. She works out regularly, and she is not leaving imminently.
Join us.
Today at 3 and again at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Getting personal with gene sequencing. A reporter gets her biological profile and finds out a lot about her heredity, including one thing she was sorry to learn. Also, cardinals look for a new pope. We'll get the view of a Vatican tour guide who says things are pretty tense right now. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. And if you're just joining us, Mohsin Hamid is our guest today on Radio Times. He lives in Lahore, Pakistan, and he writes novels. And we're talking about his newest one, How to Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I'm always curious with artists and with writers, which is if they have certain rituals or things that they do. You were talking about the importance of at least a brisk walk, which helped you to write this novel. Do you have other things that you do to get you, I guess, in character, if I can say that?
Yeah, well, when, you know, now I write first thing in the morning, and I try to be finished by lunchtime. Earlier I used to write at nights, and like from midnight till 8 a.m., but now I'm 41 years old, and I've got kids, so morning is the best time. I also have crazy rituals around the internet. You know, when I'm in full writing mode, it's like, okay, you know, I can only use the internet for like 1 hour a day maximum, because it's the ultimate procrastination vehicle.
Of course.
And, you know, it's
a whole world in there.
It's a whole world. And as a novelist, there's every excuse. He's bottling water. I wonder how much bottled water is sold. Then you're off on this train, and a day later you think, I haven't written anything, have I?
So do you use the internet as a carrot so that if you have a good morning of writing, then you allow yourself that hour on the internet? Or
I tend to think that I have a problem, actually. I think I've got this internet.
I think we all do, don't we?
It really is. And it's amazing how it's changing our brains. You know, it really does change my – I want to be connected. I want to be plugged in. I want to know what's happening on my email account, on Twitter, on Facebook, in the news. And so finding a way to disconnect from that is important because it's the very opposite in its tempo from novel writing, which is a 6-7 year project.
But do you also find that even as a writer, not that you're up against, that you're competing with the internet, but nonetheless, we live in a rather ADD world. We're all so distracted and, as you said, so attracted to things that can take us down a rabbit hole. Do you feel like you have to figure out how to get our attention and keep our attention as a writer?
Absolutely. And partly because of the internet and partly because most people I grew up with in Pakistan don't read novels.
Oh, is that right?
And so the question is, how do you write a novel that they might decide to read? And so I write small books. I spend many years writing very few pages. And part of the reason for that is that I think, you know, it's less intimidating to readers to get a small book, and also that there's a kind of respect that I have that people don't have much time. So if I can say it with less, you know, space, I ought to take the time to do that. And the other thing, of course, is that I think plot is hugely important. I mean, I'm not one of these literary novelists who thinks that there's, you know, a difference between plot-driven novels and character-driven novels. We're storytellers. And you have to, I mean, for me, I have to tell a story that grabs a reader and hopefully takes them all the way through.
Do you think the fact that you went to law school, you went to Harvard Law School, that has influenced you as a writer?
It probably has. I'm not sure how exactly. I never practiced law. I worked in business after law school. But it was, you know, there's a precision to the way that words are used in the law. And definitely going to law school gave me a real taste for that. In a sense, I think, you know, law school is like a secular clergy. You know, the way that priests of all religions take their sacred texts and treat every word as so important and parse them and interpret them. Lawyers are doing the same thing in a secular context. So, like priests, there's a lot of textual worship in the law, the Constitution, you know, the law itself is a bunch of words. So in that sense, I think it probably did have an impact.
The reason I ask is there's a certain kind of clarity to your writing. I mean, it's just, even when you're writing about sex, which you do, there's a certain, you use the word precision, but a certain kind of focus and clarity that your words have.
Well, I think partly because my whole life I've been trying to figure out how the hell to express myself. You know, I was, when I came to America at age 3, I didn't speak a word of English. And I had to learn English. And I went back to Pakistan at age 9. I'd forgotten my Urdu. And I had to learn it again. And now I've lived in America for many years. I've lived in Pakistan. I've lived in Europe. I always feel like people don't quite get what I'm trying to say. So in my fiction, at least, I try to explain it as clearly as I possibly can.
you went to law school, and not just any old law school. You went to Harvard Law School. Why didn't you practice the law? And did you go there with the intention of being a practicing attorney?
I did go there with that intention, and I had no idea what it was, the law. But I guessed I didn't respond well to it. It was not, you know, it wasn't my calling.
Right.
And I was too much of a romantic as a, you know, 20-something to pursue something that was obviously not my calling. And so I thought, well, I don't want to do this, but after law school I could get a job at a business job in New York and pay off my loans quickly. And so I did that, and then once I paid them off, eventually I was able to write full-time.
So you knew as you were in law school that you didn't want to practice law, that this was, you were too much of a romantic for
this?
Well,
in my third year of law school, there was a fantastic professor at Harvard Law School called Richard Parker, and I approached him and said, look, I want to do my law school thesis. I don't want to write a law school thesis because I don't really want to practice law. I'm just here. So I'm thinking I'll write this novel about a trial that'll explore, you know, how you can come at truth with different people offering different points of view. And he said, you know, Mohsen, I don't really want to read on the law school thesis, so do that, and I'll advise you. So my third year was spent working on my novel, actually, my first novel. Yeah.
That's the
Moth Smoke.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So Moth Smoke is structured as a trial where this pot-smoking banker in Lahore who's fallen in love with his best friend's wife has committed some crime. And the reader's trying to judge and figure out what's going on.
Hmm.
So it's a law school thesis come literary work.
Nice to have a professor that understands a student like that.
You know, I've always luckily found people like that. When I was working in New York, I was working at McKinsey & Company, which is a, you know, pretty hardcore management consulting firm. But I went to the head of the New York office and said, look, you know, I'm writing these novels and I'd love to get some time off. And so we agreed I'd take 3 months off a year and write fiction. And it's a funny thing, I think, sometimes, you know, if you're prepared to obviously take a little bit less money, and if you go to somebody and say, I've got a passion for something, oftentimes you'll find people willing to say, okay.
You live in Lahore, Pakistan now. Is that where you also grew up?
I grew up from 0 to 3 and 9 to 18 in Lahore.
In Lahore.
Yeah.
And your family, are there writers in your family?
Well, I think there's a bunch of storytellers in my family. My mother's one of 9 and my father's one of 4, and pretty much all of them are yarn spinners. And there's a real fondness for, you know, Sufi poetry, which is sung, and Qawwali, and all of those sorts of things. And in the sort of distant past, we have had sort of poets in the family. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't come from nowhere. But I think there's probably a creative streak running around where we have different people in the family who've become artists or just are quite artistic in their daily lives, whatever they happen to be.
Did you write as a kid? Were you one of those students where the teacher might say, hey, got a gift for this stuff, you?
Well, nobody said I had a gift for it, but I remember when I was in California, we were asked to write this story, and I wound up writing this entire sort of notebook full of a kind of Star Wars-like, you know, intergalactic space battle with stick figure illustrations. And I didn't do too much story writing after that, but I read a lot, and luckily my parents never tried to make me read the right kind of book. So I read comic books, and I read sci-fi, and I read fantasy, and eventually, because I loved reading, I found my way into, you know, Hemingway and Toni Morrison and whatever else. And the other thing which I say, I guess, did shape me was, as a kid, just before I left California, I got into this game called Dungeons & Dragons. And I would be really interested to know, I think a whole bunch of novelists probably who have spent part of their childhood in America, of my generation, are, you know, they don't admit this, but their but their initial fiction training was making up worlds in Dungeons & Dragons.
Wow, and that was, you were good at this?
I mean, I'm not good at it. I spent a lot of time at it, and, you know, I think this, as a child, all children, when they're small, make up these worlds, you know, that instead of us being in this studio, we're actually sitting around the deck of a boat, and right, behind us are sharks and all that kind of thing. And some kids as teenagers still want to do it. I was one of those kids, and I do it professionally as an adult, you know, to this day.
Kind of like the internet, though, isn't it? I mean, how as involving as it can be to create these worlds.
Well, this is the thing. I think there is a human desire to transcend your physical self and your actual experience. It's a huge human desire, and we have the capacity for it. And I think because we know that our physical selves are going to end one day, maybe we have this capability to go beyond ourselves. Mm. And so instead of it being a kind of infantilizing, you know, waste of time, I think that kind of, you know, fantasy is hugely important for people.
You said you have little kids. You see that in them, right?
Oh, it's incredible. My daughter comes into my room and she knocks on the door and she says, you know, who are you? And I say, I'm your father. And she says, no, I'm a little fish. Are you a jellyfish? And then I have to pretend to be a jellyfish. And she's living in that world. It's wonderful to see it.
Your movie, as I said several times, I should say your book, The Reluctant Fundamentalist, made into a movie. Did you have any hand in that? Did you assist in the screenwriting or anything related to the movie?
Yeah, I have a screen story credit, which is less than a screenplay credit. Basically, what it means is I had some hand in the initial drafts of creating the screenplay. And Mira is a really inclusive...
Mira
Nair is an inclusive and collaborative filmmaker. And so she got me onto set. She continuously came to get my advice. She stayed with me in Lahore for weeks. And you know, so I did play a part. Yeah. It's her vision. But I was among the supporting characters.
Do you think writing is like acting in a certain kind of way?
I think, in a way, novel writing is more like acting than it is like screenplay writing. Because screenplay writing is almost like outlining a novel. It's very different. Whereas in acting, I think, for me to write a novel, I have to imagine being the person whose voice is speaking that novel, or being the character, you know, being the woman who's in love with this man, or being the boy who's going to, you know. And so getting into character is a huge part of I think, what a novelist mm-hmm. does.
Let me shift gears if I can, and I'm looking at something that you wrote in the New York Times in February, and it begins, on Monday, my mother's sister and sister's eye doctor was assassinated. He was a Shiite. He was shot 6 times while driving to drop off his son at school. His son, age 12, was executed with a single shot to the head, and then you describe being part of a protest. Help us understand this violence and these what look like, at least, religious conflicts that are taking place in Lahore.
Well, I think, you know, there is this horrific rise in ethnic and interreligious violence all over the world, and definitely in Pakistan very pronouncedly. I remember growing up at a time when we didn't even know who was Shia or Sunni, and I'm hopeful that we will return to a time like that. But right now, there is a great deal of violence and extremist groups that are targeting people.
And why? I mean, what's at the root of this, do you think?
Well, nobody knows. You know, I mean, there's all sorts of theories. Some of them were created by the state to fight India. Other ones are backed by India against Pakistan. Who knows? But, and to me, in a sense, there's something else which is going on, which is that we have actually a great mental health problem. There's a profound sense of depression and dislocation in society. It's here in America, and it's even more strongly present in Pakistan, because as traditional structures are giving way, and as religion is becoming politicized, and instead of it being about spiritual values, it's about I'm in my group and you're in your group, and as the market gets tougher and tougher, people are incredibly anxious and depressed and mentally ill in many cases. Mm. And that's the environment in which I think this kind of, you know, these kind of atrocities are flourishing. There may be some similarity between, you know, kids who go to school and shoot other kids in their own school, and somebody who goes and you know, kills a whole bunch of people in a city like Lahore. It's, yes, something triggered it, but the individual themselves had some serious, you know, mental health problem.
And not that this is necessarily what your book is about, but it is about the dislocation that some people feel as they move from the country to the city and want to get rich, but lose perhaps some of the traditions, some of those connections, some of those bonds.
It's about that loss, but also I think hopefully the book is offering up, you know, at least one gesture of an antidote. Right. Which is that it is possible, you know, through art and through emotion and through empathy and connection, to mitigate these things, you know, to feel less terrible about it. And one of the central themes, and there's the strand of Muslim culture called Sufism. And in Sufism, it's very unlike what you normally hear about in the States. It's the notion that you can love the universe in such a way that you blur the boundaries between yourself and the universe, and you can lead a good life, you know, founded on love. And that's not the type of Islam you often hear about in the U.S., but it's a huge part of the tradition. And in Sufi poems, very often, they are love stories with no names, told in the second person to you. And that's something which certainly this novel, although it seems very strange in a novel, is picking up on.
And are you starting work on another novel, or are you too busy running around this country?
I'm starting work in the sense that I have ideas, I'm jotting stuff down, and I'm, you know, playing with it. But I like to starve myself in between books until I'm so desperate to write that I can stand the failure of the first 2 or 3 years.
And are you walking?
I have been walking, although I'm on a book tour right now, so I'm sort of pacing, you know, gerbil-like in my hotel room mostly.
Well, it's been a great pleasure, and thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you very much.
And congratulations on the book as well. And again, Mohsin Hamid, our guest today on Radio Times, and his novel is titled How to Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. You can find much more about this program. Fred Snyder, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, Emily Bryant helping us out today, and the show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us.